Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Before we get to our conversation about the power of adaptive sports and how you can get involved, I want to remind you that you can hear a rundown of the latest stories happening here in the Chicago area at the very end of this podcast. Now let's turn to the conversation you clicked on. This week, a group of Chicago area adaptive athletes is heading to Grand Rapids, Michigan to compete on one of the biggest stages in disability sports. The Hartford Nationals brings together competitors from across the country in events like swimming, track and field, and wheelchair tennis. Adaptive sports are all about making competition accessible by modifying rules or equipment for athletes with different abilities. So what keeps athletes coming back? And how can more Chicagoans with disabilities get involved? In this episode of the pod, we'll ask a panel of adaptive sports veterans. At the table with me was George Alfaro, coach of the Chicago Hornets, a wheelchair basketball team, Dylan Sams, who's a sports coordinator for the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab, and Larry Labiak, who's a disability policy officer for the Chicago Park District. Now, for those who might be unfamiliar, Dylan started us off with more details on adaptive sports. Here he is.
Adaptive sports are everywhere, whether that's swimming, there's wheelchair rugby, sled hockey, bocce ball, the list just keeps going and going. So there's so many different opportunities.
And Larry, I mean, how would you say adaptive sports in Chicago has evolved over the years?
Oh, immensely, immensely. The Shirley Ryan Ability Lab began an adaptive sports program more than 40 years ago.
Oh, wow.
At that time called the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago, renamed in 2017. And they started with wheelchair basketball and wheelchair softball. I was fortunate to play on one of those teams. The gentleman that started the adaptive sports was someone I had played wheelchair basketball with in college at the University of Illinois in Urbana. And he evolved, we evolved, and in the past 40 years from those grassroots to today hosting multiple years of adaptive sports regional and national tournaments.
Wow. George, your story, was captivating. I mean, a gunshot wound when you were a child is what left you unable to walk.
Correct. Around 10 years old.
10 years old. Mm-hmm. How did you get your start then with playing wheelchair basketball?
Wow. Like Larry said, I've evolved as well. The time when those programs were starting 40 years ago is almost about the time when I started playing sports. I actually met Larry and my mentor with Shirley Ryan, which was RIC at that time. And actually, I started competing in sports at the age of 14. So for 4 years, I did not know adaptive sports existed. Mm. It wasn't as popular as it is today or accessible. So, when I finally was introduced to it at 14, my God, did my life change.
Yeah. Tell me more about that, because you, for those years in between, you weren't doing much as far as, you said it was sort of a leap to go from, just kind of getting used to this new disability to just immersing yourself in a sport.
Yeah. When my injury happened, the only thing I was seeing in my life is a kid with a disability and the challenges. As soon as I was introduced to adaptive sports, I saw my lifestyle change, evolve. I started seeing other kids with my disabilities just like I, competing, having fun, commiserating, socializing, getting out there. It was more than just a sport. It was a way of life. And
now you're a coach.
Now I coach. I play a little. I play softball still, but I coach basketball.
So they say.
So I've turned it around. I was coached under Larry Labiak, and now I actually had the luxury and the honor to coach Larry as well in wheelchair softball.
Look at that. So look how the tables turned.
He passed the torch over to me. Larry, can you believe it? He actually trusted me.
How is it that you bring your own experiences, though, when you're mentoring some of those players on the team?
You know what it is? It's when people acquire a disability, we tend to focus on the things we lose, the things we cannot do, the things we cannot move. And what we do as a coach and a life mentor, we start to recalibrate that perspective into things you can do, things you will do. How will you succeed? And you are still beautiful and sexy and still an athlete. And when you recalibrate that perspective, sky's the limit for every athlete.
You know, Sasha, when I was a youngster, I was that generation just before we realized there are youngsters that need these opportunities, because wheelchair sports basketball is over 75 years, wheelchair softball almost 50. But when I was a child in Chicago, there was no opportunity because we hadn't thought to do it for kids yet.
Right. Yeah.
And George was that, you know, that test case. It's come far from an amoeba stage, obviously.
I like to consider ourselves the pioneers of, like, sports. And Dylan, who is working right now with juniors,
Dylan,
amazing.
Talk to us about that work. But first, fill us in on the Hartford Nationals, right? Because we're just days away. It's beginning later this week.
Early next week. Later this week. We'll be there early next week for swimming. So Movie Night in the Hartford Nationals is a competition. Athletes have to qualify for this. There's various sports such as swimming, para-powerlifting, track and field. And so kids, adults from all over the country will come compete, and it's an awesome time.
Wow. And tell me what it's been like to train the swimmers to get ready for the big stage like this.
They're an awesome group. They work super, super hard, and it's awesome seeing kind of where they start, maybe the beginning of the season or multiple years before, and see how much they progress, and they're just awesome to be around. It's a pleasure.
Is it? Do you find that you'll have to sort of push a little bit to sort of get them to understand their ability to reach new heights here, or is everyone sort of ready and willing to slide into the sport?
Yeah. Like all kids, they're a little stubborn
at times.
There's
a little nudging.
So
I figured.
They'll wonder, why is this workout so hard? I'm so tired. And so it's just because we're pushing a little bit harder to kind of get them to that next stage of level.
Typical teens.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Typical
exactly.
kids.
It is fun to watch you shove them in the pool, though.
Yeah, they love that. Yeah.
Safely.
Especially when I let them push me in the pool, too. That's fun.
Larry, I want to talk more about you here. You started your career in broadcasting, right? And I want to know how you pivoted then to becoming this advocate and this person working in disability policy?
Well, I was going to be the next radio star, much like yourself, many, many years ago.
Hey, it's not too late.
It isn't too late, and I'm nearing retirement. Someone made that suggestion to me just last week to return to my roots. I graduated from the University of Illinois. As I said, I played wheelchair basketball there with a degree in media, then called radio TV, worked in radio 2 years, cable in its infancy in Fresno, California. I had family in Fresno. I moved out there on a whim. 4 weeks after the idea was in my head, put in there by my older brother who lived there, I was there. Played wheelchair ball there. Ran into a young woman who broke her back hang gliding. She had two young friends in their 20s, started using aircraft quality aluminum, chromoly, to build a better wheelchair. The wheelchairs I played in when I first started were almost 50 pounds chrome steel. These were now 20, 25 pounds. They were going national. These two young bucks, you know, in a little pole barn making newfangled wheelchairs. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. When I came back to the U of I a couple of years later to get my master's degree, my friend said, well, why don't you become Illinois' first dealer for Quickie wheelchairs? I'll set you up. You can work out of your apartment. You're in one of the most accessible communities and the first accessible university in the world, the University of Illinois in Urbana. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't want to have anything to do with it. He said, you've got a student loan. And I, after an expletive, I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. I worked in that industry helping people get adaptive equipment that was more attuned to their needs for 10 years. So I became comfortable, I think, with who I was. And I realized that everyone doesn't know what I know.
Something about that position in putting you sort of directly in contact with helping folks change their lives.
And it changed
me.
I'm
sure that put a little spark in your head.
It did, because I realized that had more value than I ever imagined. Mm-hmm. And then I fell into government at the mayor's office for people with disabilities. And 20 years ago, became the first disability policy officer for the Chicago Park District. So we partner with Shirley Ryan in Adaptive Sports. We've been doing that for almost 15 years.
Can you share a bit more about what the city's done to make Chicago parks more accessible?
Never enough, although we try mightily. We have probably spent $60 to $75 million in the last 25 years to make parks more accessible to and usable by people with disabilities. But, you know, we have 250 field houses, three quarters of which were built before 1974, a mere 16 years before the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So right. In those days when these buildings were built, no one was looking at accessibility.
But you got to go play catch-up.
We play catch-up forever. We estimate, and the ADA is a great thing, but it's an unfunded mandate. So we estimate that we need at least $200 million or more to make the buildings accessible, and probably for our 600 parks, the outer grounds, on average $1 million apiece. And I can't see where $500 million is going to be available, sadly, in my lifetime. But we continue the effort. It's summertime. We have beach walks with 16 walkways through the sand. Mm-hmm. You probably saw one on your Southside Beach tour at South Shore Cultural Center
A
couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
And that's a very proud initiative. We want people to know that we have beach wheelchairs that you can use. You can get down to the water and enjoy the beach if you're in a wheelchair or have any other limiting physical situation.
Now, Dylan, we talked earlier about some of the athletes that you're working with on swimming. We caught up with 14-year-old Issa. She's one of your players. She's got spina bifida. And I want to play a little bit of her talking with our producer here about her introduction to the world of adaptive swimming.
When I first started swimming, I was feeling nervous and also scared because I was overthinking a lot, thinking, what if I drown? I first started off with a little race, and now I'm going to nationals, which is a big thing. So I can really see myself that I have improved a lot.
Tell us a little bit more about working with Issa and just her progression towards being able to compete at this national level.
Yeah. Issa's a fantastic kid. She works super, super hard, very determined, takes direction really well. Just seeing kind of her progression is amazing. And just seeing how hard she works, it's truly special to watch. And something I'll pitch too, she is also planning to attend in 2 weeks from now, we're going to a USA swimming event in Colorado Springs at the Paralympic Training Center there.
Oh, nice.
And that's a long course swim meet. So the laps will be 50 meters from one end to the other. And she's going to be competing there too, which is awesome.
How does that intensify the training behind the scenes? I mean, is it just more hours in the pool, or how do you prepare for back-to-back large competitions?
Yeah. So where we typically train in a 25-meter pool. So if you're going, let's say, a 50 meters, you'd have to go from one end back to the other. So in long course, you would just go one end to the other continuously, 50 meters. So just kind of practicing more of that endurance versus having to have a turn and head back. And then having her come to nationals will be good practice as well.
That's so exciting.
Yeah.
You were smiling, George, as you listened to Issa talk there. What was coming to your mind?
That's where I was. I was in Issa.
Yeah.
I started young, scared.
Practically the same age.
Same age, basically. Same competition. But under great tutelage and great coaches and great mentorship, I have no doubt that she's going to be a star. I mean, I've done very much with my sports career. I've gotten softball championships. I've gotten, accolades and inducted to the Hall of Fame for softball.
So, congratulations.
Yeah, and I started just the same way Issa did.
What do you think ultimately got you from that, that uncertain kid to this confident athlete now?
My peers, my friends. The minute I met, not just sports, but my friends, the brotherhood, how they embraced me. I wasn't just, a kid in a wheelchair that's last to be picked at the field, for me, all the able-bodied kids playing sports. But here I am, one of the awesome kids, one of the elite kids. And my best friends, my friends, my teammates were the ones that helped me manage through a time in my childhood that was pretty challenging.
Now, it was clear, especially earlier, that you and Larry know each other.
Very much so.
You've got some history. How did you two meet?
Larry is one of my mentors. He mentioned a person who he grew up with, Bob Trotter, who was my mentor as well. So Larry and Bob kind of like introduced me to wheelchair sports, they kind of told me about, you know, other kids that are playing the sport. So I grew up playing sports with adults. There was no junior program at all. So we were playing with grown men riding the bench, wondering when we're going to play. But great coaching and great mentorship. And yeah, I mean, that was, I'm 57 years old now. I met Larry when I was about 14, 15 years old.
And you know, George talks about the camaraderie. The first wheelchair basketball team in Chicago was a basic black team plus me, the Chicago Pacemakers. We used to practice at a Catholic church in Chatham. Mm-hmm. And these are guys that I had gone to school with, because in those days, you know, we were all segregated, racially integrated, interestingly, but segregated from people without disabilities in the Chicago public school system. So then here comes George as a 14-year-old with two of his buddies, Eric and Earl, and they were our first junior athletes. And, you know, Sasha, these are successful people, right? We talked about Issa, the swimmer. Sport isn't an end to itself, just like it's not with kids without disabilities.
Right.
We want them to get an education, to fully enjoy life. To be employed eventually.
This is just one component.
And pay taxes.
Yeah.
I'm a taxpayer.
You can't escape that. Right. In the years post-COVID, Larry, how have you seen the need for disability support grow?
On so many levels. Not only youngsters with physical disabilities, because there is so much isolation exacerbated by COVID, exacerbated by cultural issues pre and post-COVID, but so many more social isolation issues, psychosocial issues that are affecting individuals with and without disabilities. And as George said, the social part of this is to help us break down the internal barriers in our own heads, in our own bodies, to know that we can build confidence. If you had a recent injury, George can talk to the next guy or gal who got shot and say, this is how you do this. This is how you get into your car. This is how you get into your house. These are the challenges you're going to face. Hey, don't be a knucklehead. Or if you are a knucklehead, be a good athlete. Straighten out your life. Follow the leaders.
Yeah. I want to hear from all of you. What more do you think needs to be done, whether it be the local level, state level, federal level, just to increase that support for people with disabilities?
I'll let Larry. Well, I think...
George, you first.
Probably awareness. It's just, and I'll throw this word out there, marketing. I think it just has to be marketed a whole lot better. I mean, there's great jobs going. I mean, there's great doings going on right now.
So you mean getting out there that there are opportunities?
Yes. I mean, getting out there.
With and without disabilities.
With and without disabilities. I like for our games and our events to be publicized or at least talked about in like mainstream schools, high schools, whether it's maybe there might be a lost kid there that has a disability that doesn't know that it exists, or maybe some people just want to come out and volunteer and help.
Yeah.
I think once you just put the word out there and just really wave a big banner that there is adaptive sports, I think people will see it.
Constantly looking for new kids to play
and
new adults. We're in a huge city. People don't know. We want them to know. They can contact Shirley Ron Ability Lab or the Chicago Park District. They will, whoever picks up the phone or via email or text, will get them to us. And we're going to get them in the pool and on the playing field.
Anybody listening to WBEZ, call us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let us know.
Last word to you, Dylan. Anything more that you think needs to be done? And how can folks get involved with adaptive sports?
Yeah, kind of seconding these two. It's the awareness piece. It's I've had athletes who email me, show up to programs, and they go, oh, I didn't know you had this program too. You have this. I can try out this. And it's almost just appalling that people don't know, but we just need to get all this information to their hands and get them out here.
And we have the equipment and we have all the support.
So Shirley Ryan Ability Lab is the place to start if you want information.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like. All right. We'll leave it there. Dylan Sams is sports coordinator at Shirley Ryan Ability Lab. George Alfaro is a coach of the Chicago Hornets, a wheelchair basketball team. And Larry Labiak is a disability policy officer with the Chicago Park District. Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
we'll dig into the top stories of the day, from new guardrails around the use of AI to the taste of Chicago. We'll break down the day's news so far with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, WBEZ senior producer Meha Ahmed, and Sun-Times government and politics reporter Mitchell Armentrout. It's a beautiful sunny day, right?
We've had a nice one yesterday, too.
It was really nice. I enjoyed it. The sunnies were on.
I watched the USA game in the backyard.
Oh, how lovely.
Had a little TV set up. It was perfect.
That's a cute setup.
The sun didn't set until after 8 p.m. last night. It's, again, we get reminded every summer why Chicago is a great place to be in the summer. And we act surprised.
Yeah, Meha, you and I were on the CTA for a little bit yesterday afternoon, enjoying the sunshine coming through the windows.
And the lovely breeze.
The lovely breeze.
Just enjoying the view of the city.
Mitch, are you checking out baseball games in the
How's
midst
that
of the
press
sun?
Box?
The press box, the weather's fine in the press box, usually. Sometimes they open the windows when it's like 90, and you know, I'm one of the whiny guys.
They
I'm
wait
like,
till it's 90?
It
You're one of the whiny guys?
Yeah.
Well, Claire, you have an update, though.
I do.
This is on the rain that's been plaguing us.
Yeah, we've definitely gotten our fair share of rain. I mean, over the weekend, it was pretty much relentless with the downpours. But O'Hare, which is a common place where we tally some of the rain totals, has apparently received as much rain so far this month, mind you, it's the 7th day of July, as it typically gets for the entirety of the month of July.
Ooh, wow.
So we've already received that much rain. National Weather Service says about 3.5 inches fell between last Thursday through Sunday, so over the entire holiday weekend. Areas south and west of Chicago, this is like Yorkville, Oswego, Aurora, recorded 6 to 8 inches during that same time period. Storms are going to re-enter the forecast later this week, likely not until early Thursday.
Oh, boy.
Thursday afternoon, potentially, and that's when we're likely to get a heavier downpour.
Those
but
storms,
in the clear until then.
They keep me up at night, those storms.
But keep your shades on for now.
Yes, for now, for now. Lots of people, though, still reeling, Mitch, from the floodings last week, and our colleague Brett Chase has an update on how that's impacting Chicago's reservoir system.
Right, this is the deep tunnel system that's like hundreds of miles of underground pipes basically from different suburbs that are basically directs all the rainwater into these two giant reservoirs. One is near Stickney. The other one's out in South Holland. You've probably driven by it on 8094 if you're driving towards Indiana. And if you drove by it yesterday or today, you'd see it looks like a little ocean out there because it's essentially full. Yesterday it was, or it's been fluctuated for the last day between 96% and completely full. Which is unprecedented.
How big of a deal is that it's nearly at capacity?
Well, it's not a great sign because there's nowhere else for that water to go, and that is not water that you want to be anywhere near. That's sewage, that is stormwater, that is stuff that's coming down people's toilets, and that's why we've got this giant system. It's still under construction, and that's kind of one. This is sort of highlighting the need to sort of accelerate the completion of that project. But yeah, just kind of goes to show, you know, weather in Chicago is pretty crazy, but this is something different, it seems like, this year.
Trying to figure out how to segue from toilet water to the taste of Chicago.
We're going to do it.
We're going to do it, Meha, because it is back.
That's a tough one. I'm stumped, actually.
Right.
That's a hard turn.
You're the queen of segues.
Yeah, we're going to do happy Chicago news. The taste of Chicago is back, and it's back in July, where it always has lived. But for the last few years, people may know that it was shoved over to September to make room for the NASCAR race. But it's back in its home weekend of July. So it starts tomorrow and goes through the weekend. People may have noticed the street closures began, I think, last week. I was driving in today from the South Loop, and I could see I took a cab, and the cab driver was struggling to figure out how to get from the South Loop to Navy Pier because of just the sheer number of street closures. But and I had to be reminded. I was like, I didn't know why the streets were closed because I'd forgotten that the taste
was
supposed to be in July.
Right? Yeah. No, I'm emceeing one of the days for a little bit, and so it'll actually be my first time at the taste. I'm like, how have my kids been multiple times, and I have not. And what's nearly 6 years in Chicago?
Well, back in the day, it used to be like 2 weeks long. And so you'd encounter, and this is pre-COVID, but you'd encounter a lot of business people just going to have lunch at the Taste.
Yeah.
And now it really has become more of like a, you know, a concert thing, and the, you know, the food's still excellent, but it's quite an event.
I'm definitely going to do more than just work.
We know you will be eating.
I'm going to eat, that's for sure. So what other main attractions are coming this year? Who's headlining?
So it was pretty exciting with some hometown heroes, Beach Bunny and Common. And then we got Grammy-winning reggae artist Original Coffee, R&B singer Babyface, and Mexican pop star Julieta Venegas. So Beach Bunny's kicking things off tomorrow, Original Coffee on Thursday, Common Friday, Babyface on Saturday, and Julieta on just bringing it all home on Sunday.
Right.
You said it was your first time going. As Claire said earlier, the rain is going to re-enter the forecast later this week.
Ooh, that's right.
But rain doesn't keep us home in Chicago.
That's right.
Unless it's like a severe storm, avoid it. But if it's just rain, I mean, grab a poncho, grab an umbrella.
I'll still be out there. That's for sure. I'll just be protected.
Food, tickets at the Taste. Enjoy it. Yeah.
Now, in other news, Claire, former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel is in Tel Aviv, and he's planning on delivering a very strong message. About what?
So this is about U.S.-Israeli relations. What he is saying is that they are at a crossroads. So Emanuel, he's been popping back up in the news the last couple of weeks, rumored to be running for president. But he is essentially arguing that changes are needed between the conflict in Iran, including sanctions on Israelis who attack Palestinians, and an end, you know, essentially to the U.S. subsidies to Israel's defense budget. A lot of money passing through both sides of this. But according to the Associated Press, Emanuel is going to just publicly kind of criticize and call out Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for leading Israel to what he's calling a dead end. And he's also saying that, you know, this unconditional support from the U.S. has been a huge mistake. So we'll see if this elicits some kind of response from Netanyahu once these remarks are made. TBD, but we'll have the news for you when he makes these statements.
Now, Mitch, Governor Pritzker signed an AI bill into law, and it's being called America's strongest AI safety bill, right?
Yeah, this is Illinois' first attempt to sort of rein in the ChatGPTs, OpenAIs, Claudes of the world. And basically what the idea is here is that all these big companies, they have to basically put together safety plans in place for if bad actors use their platforms to, say, try to create a nuclear bomb or a biological weapon or really like big, massive problems that some of this technology can pose. And, you know, even like the state is now mandating that these companies kind of envision other scenarios that we haven't even thought of yet, because this technology is obviously changing very rapidly.
I'm getting more and more frightened by AI and its capabilities by the day.
Right.
Just with more
so
that I learn.
Better so quickly.
Yes.
I mean, even some of the videos I used to question like 3 months ago have improved substantially.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so like really like no one really has an idea of where it's going.
Right.
So like the state is mandating that these companies basically lay out some sort of roadmap for what people could potentially expect and what they're doing to prevent these doomsday scenarios that we can't entirely rule out, which is a little unnerving. But yeah, so this is, you know, a few other states have tried to implement some guardrails around AI, but it's hard to do.
Let's hear a little bit from Pritzker himself and what he had to say about the bill.
Look, this is not about punishing businesses or stifling the potential of this technology, quite the opposite. It's simply about addressing some of the dangers that AI can pose.
So you mentioned there, you started to talk there, Mitch, about other states, right? Tell us how Illinois is comparing nationally when it comes to AI bills like this and where lawmakers seem to be weighing in.
So this basically follows a model that has already been implemented in New York and California with this idea of making companies adhere to these safety plans that they come up with. But where Illinois goes one step further is that these companies also have to submit to a yearly independent audit each year. So basically have someone from outside their company come in, take a look at their safety plan, what they're doing, and whether they're meeting Illinois' requirements or not. And if they don't, then they could face fines of up to $3 million, which sounds like a lot, but also some of these AI labs are being valued at nearly a trillion, T-R-illion dollars. So like that's kind of water in the bucket.
T-R. Forget billion with a B. Now we've got to like differentiate the T-R.
Yeah, it's like
that's
really just kind of incomprehensible amounts of money. So it's hard to say like exactly how much this is actually going to deter companies for, you know, make sure that they're actually following these rules.
It's a speeding ticket, really.
Yeah, if that, yeah.
I mean, the AG, Kwame Raoul, said that $3 million, he would argue that it's not enough, but that it was a beginning step.
Yeah.
I mean, they could always revisit this law down the line, see how it works out. This goes into effect. These companies have to start submitting these plans next January, this upcoming January. So we'll see where they go from there.
All right. Other news on your radar, Claire?
Yes, mourning the loss this morning of George E. Johnson, the founder of Johnson Products Company. He died, sometimes confirmed, Monday. He was 99 years old, but he was lauded as a pioneer in black hair care products, founded his company in 1954, turned it into a multi-million dollar business,
Legend.
But yeah, in 1971, Southside Business became the first black-owned company to trade on the American Stock Exchange, and he died in his downtown Chicago condo. So,
wow,
local till the end.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Very good. We talked earlier, Meha, about Taste of Chicago and the headliners. Mm-hmm. What other fun summer shows are going on? My kid yesterday just got her Lala wristbands in the mail. I thought, oh, should I have, you know, taken care of myself there and made sure that I was, you know, taking part
in
some
kind of... Can you piggyback on that? Can you tag along with your kid?
They get a summer job and they use their money to buy the things. This is what you want as a parent, right?
Yeah,
for them
to
buy the things that they need. She didn't ask me for Lala tickets. And I was like, okay.
As long as I don't have to pay for it.
She was like, forget your media access, Mom. I'm going to use my hard-earned summer dollars.
That's what we want to hear. As far as other shows, our colleague Sophie Hernandez-Simeonidas, she has a roundup of 10 concerts happening this summer. You can check that out at WBEZ.org. And she's included, you know, Common and Beach Bunny, their shows at Taste of Chicago. But one that I want to shout out that she highlighted was at the CSO, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra's opening night of its Ravinia residency this year will feature two famous guest soloists. One is Yun Chan Lim, sort of a 22-year-old wunderkind pianist. Mm. And the other is Lizzo, the pop artist Lizzo.
Lizzo.
Yes, who will play the flute with the CSO. Famously, she is a classically trained flautist.
Of course. Yeah, that is so cool, actually. Are you taking in the summer concert vibes, Mitch?
I haven't yet as much as I would like. I was actually just thinking, I've not been to Ravinia in a few years. And that really is, that's like a really great Chicago. It's obviously not within Chicago borders,
area.
But like
Chicago
you take
area.
Metro up to Ravinia, have yourself a really nice glass of wine on the lawn, enjoy whoever's playing. It's like a really fun time.
Ravinia's lovely. I went up there with Dennis Rodkin to do a
What's That Building? Yeah.
Segment a couple of years ago, and it was wonderful. I was like, what is this campus that I've stepped onto? It's absolutely gorgeous. I'm looking forward to it. I should probably
visit at least once if you haven't gone.
Ethan was there too, our engineer. We had a good time because we did a summer series just checking out a bunch of music venues, and that one was like clearly like the highlight. If I must say so myself. What other stories are you following, Mitch? Baseball's got to be in there somewhere.
Looking forward to seeing how the White Sox rebound. They had a really nice series split. It looked like they were going to drop they dropped the first two games of a series to their top rivals, the Cleveland Guardians, battling it out for first place. So right now the White Sox are clinging to a one game lead in the division. Sox versus Sox tonight on the south side. Boston is in town. So it's another pretty good test for the White Sox, who are, you know, basically trying to open their contending window a little bit earlier than anyone expected. Pleasant surprise.
It also must be an amazing time for you to cover the White Sox, considering where they were last season.
Yeah, I mean, the last three seasons. This is, we're talking about 2 years ago. This is literally the worst team in modern baseball history. So really a remarkable turnaround.
And we're still doing pretty well, like enough to brag to my family.
You can absolutely brag. Yeah. I know there's your Blue Jays are having a little trouble in the division.
They are. But I wasn't going to mention it, Mitch. I can't believe you went there. That's kind of rude.
But the Blues have a bunch of guys in the All-Star game, so you've got that to look forward to next week. That'll be fun for you.
Yeah, I got to check out a Sox game really soon. There's nothing better than, I think, going to a sports game when, like, the fans can be hyped about something. Like, it's a good time. They were on a winning streak. It's just... the vibes, the excitement is just
unparalleled. And White Sox fans in particular are really invested in their team. I mean, I'm around it a lot, so I guess I'm biased in that way. But, this is a very smart and, like, very tuned-in fan base. So it is a fun thing to be around.
Love that for us. WBEZ's Claire Lane and Meha Ahmed and Mitchell Armantrout with the Sun-Times.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Ginny Kim. It was edited by Ethan Traub. Sasha M. Simons is our host. If you like what you just heard, we hope you join us for more and head over to wbz.org/in the loop or subscribe to this feed so you never miss a conversation. Thanks for listening.